Again, for the benefit of all, Judge Sparks will be participating by telephone because he got so stuck that he turned around and went home. So he'll be participating by phone. Next case, United States v. Firth. Appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
The government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Suki, members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Major Scott Martin, and together with my co-counsel, Captain Paul Shirk, I represent the appellant in this court, the case, Lieutenant Firth. With the court's permission, I'd ask to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
In 2017, the Supreme Court decided Lee v. United States. Lee, like Lieutenant Firth, had been erroneously advised by his counsel regarding the consequences of a plea. In that case, the Supreme Court noted two important facts. First was that Lee had no real defense to the charge against him. And second was that Lee, by pleading guilty, received significantly less jail time than what he would have faced had he gone to trial. Based on those two facts, the government and Lee argued, just as they argue here today, that pleading not guilty cannot be a rational choice. The Supreme Court, however, rejected that argument. They held instead that in cases such as these, the proper area of focus is not on what might have happened had the matter proceeded to a hypothetical trial. Instead, the proper area of focus is on the decision-making processes of an accused, to include, critically, their understanding and assessment of the consequences of the plea. For that reason, the Supreme Court held that when an individual places particular importance on avoiding the consequence of a guilty plea, pleading not guilty can be a rational decision, even if that individual has no real defense at trial, and even if doing so means foregoing the benefits of a plea agreement. In this case, Lieutenant Firth's counsel failed at basic lawyering 101. They provided advice and guidance to their client on a matter of importance to Lieutenant Firth without first reading and understanding the controlling statute.
Okay. The issue before us is IAC.
Yes, Your Honor.
This case is such a mess, and half of it's a collateral issue that we don't have jurisdiction over. But this case reminds me of the famous California Supreme Court case from about 1960, where it was held that drafting a will that violated the rule against perpetuities wasn't legal malpractice because no one knew what the rule against perpetuities meant. Here you've got a situation where you had I call him a RILO because that's what the Air Force calls him, a RIFGOS, a resignation for the good of the service, which is an administrative matter over which we don't have jurisdiction. The Army appears to treat them differently from all the other services. The statute is by no means clear. All you've got is an Army CCA opinion that purports to interpret it. As Lincoln once said, if all wisdom were given to me, I wouldn't know what to do in the present situation. And I feel some sympathy for counsel in the same situation. So where are we in this mess?
Your Honor, you stated that the statute isn't clear. I would respectfully disagree with that. I believe when you...
Well, the statute says that the convening authority can't do certain things.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The statute does not affect the authority of the Secretary of the Army to run the Army, to discharge people, including requests in lieu of court-martial, query whether Congress intended that to be a limitation on the Secretary of the Army's ability to tell the convening authority what to do. or query whether, regardless of that, the Secretary of the Army can't discharge him anyway directly.
Your Honor, I know there's two parts to the RFGOS. First is the discharge, and the second part is either terminating a court-martial proceeding or vacating one that's already taken place. The regulations in place at the time made it clear that the way that latter part was effectuated was through the convening authority disapproving the findings, if a court-martial had in fact taken place. Everybody understood that was the case. Article 60 very clearly removed the convening authority's authority to do that in all but the most limited cases. And again, if counsel had simply looked at the statute here, read the statute, understood the statute.
Did anybody else look at the statute? I guess the Court of Criminal Appeals looked at the statute in this In Re Elmo what's-his-name thing.
Thanks, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Prior to that, there was an unpublished Army opinion.
Yeah, was there a published Army opinion? Had the general counsel construed the statute? Did DODGC do anything?
There was not a published opinion. And I think the question the court should be asking itself is not how many people got this wrong, but why they got it wrong. And the reason they got it wrong
because this thing's a total mess.
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I believe if there's an excuse for why they got it wrong, it's institutional inertia. They'd always been doing it one way, so they kept doing it that way. The changes to Article 60 weren't shrouded in mystery. They were well-published, and the statute itself is unambiguous and clear. The first substantive rule of the Rules of Professional Responsibility is competence. If this court is going to say that the counsel is not required to read the controlling statute before advising their client on that statute's effect, I think that would be a very dangerous and unfortunate precedent to set for the practice of law within the military justice system, Your Honor.
Counsel, does the government contest the first prong of Strickland?
They don't expressly concede it, but nowhere in their brief do they contest deficient performance.
Well, for instance, on page 6 and page 8 of the government's brief, the government refers to trial defense counsel's, quote, erroneous advice, end quote. So isn't that essentially a concession by the government? Of course, I'll be asking government counsel that.
I would say that they conceded in so much. They don't use the language deficient performance, but yes, they do admit that it was erroneous advice. They don't contest that the advice was erroneous.
So doesn't this, if that is the case, and I'm not saying that that is what this court will decide, but let's assume for a minute that, in fact, the issue of whether it was erroneous advice is not in front of us. Isn't then the key the Supreme Court's decision in Padilla, where the Supreme Court said that it all comes down to, quote, a decision to reject the plea bargain would have been rational under the circumstances?
I think there's two prongs to prejudice. First is whether or not the individual would have pled not guilty but for the deficient performance, and the second is whether or not the decision would be rational. So,
what is the distinction you're drawing there? Could you flesh that out for me, please?
Sure. I think the first prong of that is pretty straightforward. We look for evidence in the appellant's declaration, and then we look for contemporaneous evidence that supports that declaration. And here, of course, we do have the declaration, but I do want to talk about...
Now, when you say the declaration, you're talking about the assertion by appellant that he would not have pleaded guilty if he had known. Hasn't the Supreme Court said, well, that's something you may consider, but it's certainly not dispositive of the issue?
I would agree, Your Honor, and I think the exact language in Lee is court should not rely solely on the after-the-fact assertion. They should look to contemporaneous evidence, and I'd like to go through
the... So in terms of the contemporaneous evidence, what we're looking at is we're placing ourselves in the position that appellant found himself prior to hearing about the fact that the resignation had been approved by the Secretary's designation.
Of course, he didn't have the benefit of that knowledge, Your Honor. And I think if you look at the timeline here, that's a good starting point. Charges were preferred against him on the 16th of January or the 11th of January, and only 15 days later, he submitted the RFGOS. That was the very first order of business. That was Plan A. We know based on defense counsel's affidavit, they had the conversation at that point, and Lieutenant Firth was given erroneous advice. Now, as I said, the RFGOS was Plan A. The OTP was not submitted until 2 months later. That was certainly not Plan A. That was Plan B once the RIF-GOS was put into effect. They had the conversation again at that point, and then we know that second-tier counsel wasn't appointed here until April 5th, and after that point, second-tier counsel, first-tier counsel, went and discussed this matter with their senior defense counsel because it was of such importance. Now, over 2.5 months after that first conversation where they gave the erroneous advice, this is still a hot issue, so hot that they feel the need to discuss it with their senior defense counsel.
Okay, you're looking at the procedural aspects, I understand. But don't we have to, this court, don't we need to be looking at what the contemporaneous evidence was in terms of he was facing serious charges here, quite serious charges, desertion, larceny from the military in excess of $500. The government's case was extremely strong. He was being offered a plea deal that was not a sweetheart deal, but it was very favorable. Why shouldn't we be looking at that to include this idea that he could have lost the benefit of that plea deal if he had contested it? And the fact that if, and I'm sure you'll contest this, but in light of the fact that everyone in the chain of command had recommended turning down this resignation request, why wouldn't he have been sitting back there, and even if he knew how this would have played out, he'd say, this is a crapshoot, and I am not going to subject myself to conviction for these serious offenses and the potential serious punishment that could be imposed?
Your Honor, again, there are two different issues here. Whether or not this was a rational decision, Lee makes it very clear that even the so-called Hail Mary pass can be a rational choice if an individual places importance on the course of action they're hoping to achieve.
But aren't you gliding over what that case was about? What the defendant in that case was trying to avoid was, as I recall, deportation.
And Lieutenant,
here it seems like you're almost equating this concept of what he's trying to avoid is getting a conviction. But that would be true in any case.
Your Honor, it is that to some extent. His goal was to avoid conviction, but the means by which he sought to achieve that end was through the timely approval of his RIF-GOS. So when he pled guilty, he foreclosed the possibility that the secretary could give him the benefit of an approved RIF-GOS. That was what was foreclosed when he pled guilty, and that's what he was not willing to do. And as you mentioned, the chain of command recommended disapproval. We cite two cases. There's Firth itself, and there's a recent unpublished Army opinion, De Los Santos. That's the entire appellate record we have dealing with this issue. And in every single one of those cases, the chain of command recommended disapproval, and lo and behold, the RIF-GOS was in fact approved. So this notion that a RIF-GOS approval is a long shot, or that chain of command recommendations prevent it from being approved, the evidence doesn't bear that out. Now, a sample size of four is a small sample size, but all the evidence that is before this court in the appellate record suggests that those facts did not suggest that the RIF-GOS wasn't going to be disapproved.
Does the Secretary of the Army, under the present regime, have the power to grant an administrative discharge in lieu of court-martial?
He may grant a discharge in lieu of a punitive discharge, but he may not disapprove findings. And that's the issue here, that when he pled guilty, unbeknownst to him because of the deficient performance of counsel, the Secretary of the Army or his designee would no longer be able to vacate his court-martial proceeding.
Okay, he got a... Where is he? Is he in the Army or out of it?
He's out of the Army, Your Honor.
He's out of the Army with a UOTHC?
We would call it an OTH, Your Honor, yes.
Yeah, what we used to call an undesirable, an administrative discharge of the lowest characterization.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right. Okay, so he's out. He got a dismissal, some confinement, and a reprimand. Okay, the dismissal's out because he's out with the UOTHC. The time's been served, So are we just sitting here talking about a reprimand?
We're talking about a criminal conviction, Your Honor. That's a stigma he's going to have to bear for the remainder of his life. And it's one he wouldn't have to bear had he been properly advised. If he had been properly advised by counsel, he would not have pled guilty in April of 2018 or at any other point relevant to this proceeding.
Counsel, well, let's talk about what, and you, Justice Newbury, what would he have done? When he shows up at that hearing, he's going to plead not guilty? I think you have another answer.
Well, if you force me to answer that on that day, yes, he will plead not guilty. But we're not just looking at what happened on that day. We need to look at the entire process. He was misadvised in January. If he had been properly advised in January, he would have told his counsel, look, I'm not pleading guilty as long as this Rif Goss is out there pending. And at that point, his counsel would have been forced to prepare for trial. We know on JA-40 that his counsel waived the preliminary hearing. We know that his counsel did not request discovery in this case because counsel had no idea that that would be an issue and interfere with the Rif Goss. But if he had told counsel, I'm not pleading guilty as long as this thing's pending, counsel would have had to prepare for trial. And we're only talking about 34 days here. Almost certainly, that would have taken at least 34 days to hold a preliminary hearing, to request discovery, to litigate any matters that might have arisen under that. And we wouldn't be here today, and Lieutenant Firth wouldn't have a criminal conviction.
So maybe I misunderstood your briefs. I thought you had said that what he would have done was requested a continuance, and that leads me to the question of, do we then have to evaluate how likely he would have been to get one? But I think your answer you're telling me now is that there were half a dozen other ways he could have slow-rolled this process.
I wouldn't call it slow rolling. I would call it preparing for trial, because if he's not going to plead guilty, then he does have to prepare for trial. So it's not gaming the system. I
didn't mean to imply that they were illegitimate means of delaying the start of the trial, but he would have taken actions that would have necessarily delayed the start of the trial.
Yes, Your Honor. And I don't want to say that the continuance wasn't an option. It certainly was, but it wasn't the only option. And we know from the unpublished case Brown, which is appended to our reply brief, that in that case, counsel called up HRC, and they actually got an update from HRC that, hey, this is going to take X amount of days to get you an answer on the Rif Goss. So the counsel could have done that in this case had they understood what was going on, but they didn't. And they would have learned. They really only needed to by about a month in order to achieve Lieutenant Firth's desired course of action.
Counsel, before you run out of time, can I ask a question? For the purpose of Lee, does it matter whether his declaration is, I would not have pleaded guilty versus I would have pleaded not guilty?
May I answer?
Answer.
I believe the language in the case law is a reasonable probability that he would have not pled guilty, not that he would have pled not guilty. But I think it's really semantics. If you read what he says there, I would not have pleaded guilty prior to receiving a decision on my Rif Goss. If we just sort of plug that into a computer and say May 2018, April 2018, would he have pled guilty? Well, was the Rif Goss pending? Yes, it was. Well, then he would not have pled guilty.
Mr. Chief Justice, may I ask another question?
Go ahead.
Suppose that we conclude that what he has declared and the other evidence is sufficient under Lee. Do we have to remand it so that there can be an evidentiary hearing to see whether he's telling the truth?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and that's because the evidence here is uncontroverted. We have an uncontroverted declaration, and we do have the contemporaneous evidence, which is the fact that this was an issue that arose over and over again. It's something he's talking to his counsel about over and over again. You've seen his declaration. He even went so far as to check the regulation himself. So this court can conclude based on the declaration and the contemporaneous evidence that this was, in fact, an issue of key importance. And under this court's precedent in Gin, we have a declaration. It's uncontested and is corroborated by contemporaneous evidence. The government had the opportunity to obtain more affidavits or seek further evidence at the service court, and this is a record before the court at this point, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Chief Judge.
Judge Sparks, do you have any questions?
No, thank you.
Okay. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Mark Emond. Myself, along with Major Dustin Myrie. We represent the United States. Appellant's IAC claim is easily set aside on the second Strickland prong as he fails to show prejudice. To establish prejudice in a guilty plea context, appellant must establish that if he was advised correctly, both, one, that he would have pled not guilty, and secondly, that it would have been objectively reasonable for him to do so. Appellant offers neither. Even if appellant had been properly advised on his RFGOS, his court-martial still would have taken place on April 18th, and he still would have pled guilty. Appellant does not assert that but for his counsel's errors, he would have pled not guilty on April 18th and would have insisted on going to trial. Instead, he states that he would have pled guilty, but just at a later time. His sole focus is on delaying his court-martial. The reason that he would still have pled guilty is that it was the only reasonable choice. When appellant walked into court on April 18th, he was presented with two choices. He could either plead guilty or plead not guilty. And he chose the only reasonable option, which was to maintain the very favorable plea deal that his counsel had negotiated for him. If he had opted to plead not guilty, the RFGOS still would have had the same effect. It would not have been able to negate the findings, and it would not have been able to negate the confinement that was adjudged. The only difference, if he had pled not guilty, would be that he would have more serious convictions as well as a lengthier prison sentence, most likely. Appellant had a very favorable deal. As Judge Olson pointed out, he was able to plead to AWOL in excess of 30 days and wrongful appropriation with a cap on confinement of just 9 months. He got this instead of having to face the charges of desertion and larceny of government property in excess of $500, which carried a max sentence of 12 years. And the evidence against him was strong. For the desertion charge, he was gone for 21 months. He had moved halfway across the country and lived with his girlfriend. He sought alternate employment, and it wasn't until he was literally down to his last dollar that he came back to the Army. For the larceny charge, he was paid $27,000 while he was AWOL and not working for the Army.
That's an interesting question. I assume he was on the rolls as a deserter, right? Or originally AWOL, and then normally after 30 days, don't they go to desertion?
Yes, Your Honor. The difficulty here was that he was...
Why was he paid? I mean, this is an extraneous question, but that's the first thing that popped into my mind was, did the Army continue paying him all this time?
He was paid because he had been PCSing from an OCONUS duty location to a CONUS duty location. So the obligation to drop him from the rolls and put him in an AWOL status fell on his gaining unit rather than his OCONUS unit, where the normal process is that the losing unit, if he's
okay,
AWOL.
So the gaining unit had the responsibility, and they didn't do it?
I don't want to speculate, Your Honor.
Well, I'm not speculating, but you're talking about $27,000 here.
He did continue to get paid.
He did continue to get paid for the whole period of his absence?
Not for the entire period of his absence, Your Honor. He was paid for a few months. I believe it was 4 months that he continued to get paid and was paid $27,000.
Okay, which was the subject of the spec for wrongful appropriation.
Yes, Your Honor. Originally a larceny.
Yeah. Okay, let me ask you what I asked counsel for the appellant. What are the powers of the Secretary of the Army in a case where a RFGOS is filed? Assuming the Secretary wants to grant it, or the Secretary's designee, what are the powers of the Secretary of the Army? Can he do it?
The Secretary of the Army can issue an administrative...
I realize this is an administrative question, not a justice question, but what can the Secretary of the Army do under the present regime, under the present Article 60?
The Secretary of the Army is able to effectuate an administrative discharge.
In lieu of a dismissal?
The updated version of AR 2710 uses the Secretary of the Army's Article 74 powers to replace the dismissal with an administrative discharge.
Okay.
Following a court-martial. So
So, wait a minute. So he can do it.
He can effectuate an administrative discharge.
He can give the UOTHC.
He cannot, however, disapprove the findings.
He cannot he can, well, even though he is a convening authority himself, but he can't order the convening authority to disprove findings.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And he can't disprove them himself.
Under Article 60, no.
Well, it seems I'm not sure Article 60 says anything about it, about the powers of the Secretary.
Your Honor, under Clinton v. Goldsmith, that's a question that this Court doesn't necessarily have to answer.
I realize all that, but this has something to do with, frankly, whether there was substandard performance by counsel. I mean, if nobody knows what the hell is going on, and nobody knows what the Secretary of the Army can do, then how is counsel expected to know?
And that's a question to be addressed on the first prong of Strickland. And to
clarify, yeah, exactly.
The government does not concede.
Does the government concede deficient performance?
No, Your Honor. Okay. Counsel concedes that the advice on the RIFGOS on a separate and distinct administrative matter was erroneous. However, looking at the totality of the representation by the counsel, they submitted the RIFGOS. They had a plan A. They did not just rest on their laurels with the RIFGOS. They submitted an OTA or an offer to plead guilty, negotiated very favorable terms, and then through their zealous advocacy within the guilty plea, were able to beat those terms and only get a three-month confinement sentence, even though they had negotiated a cap of 9 months and pleading to two lesser-included offenses instead of the larceny and the desertion. And the evidence was strong. For the larceny, he was paid the $27,000. He spent it all. He literally had 97 cents in his bank account, and he had no clear means to pay it back. And there would not have been any advantage for him when he walked into court on April 18th for him to have pled not guilty. If he had been advised correctly, he would have known that he would be stuck with the findings and the confinement that was adjudged on that day.
Well, he'd be stuck with a dismissal.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
He'd be stuck with a dismissal.
If he had been advised correctly,
this is a prosecutorial question, but is the Army going to let a commissioned officer who's gone for a lengthy period of time and who walks away with $27,000, which he spends, out without a dismissal if he's tried by a general court-martial?
No, Your Honor. Either way, a dismissal was...
That strikes me as odd.
No matter how appellant pled, he was going to get a dismissal when he was tried.
If he ends up pleading to a court-martial, I can't imagine them giving him a deal that didn't include a dismissal.
Even if he had pled not guilty, he would have gotten a dismissal. The government's evidence was extremely strong. And he was a second lieutenant who had absconded when he headed to his second duty station and was gone for 21 months. He was gone for nearly as long as he had been in the Army. There's no way that he would have not been issued a dismissal. And so the only two terms that remained, the confinement and the findings, his counsel negotiated very favorably for him to get two lesser-included offenses and cut 12 years down to 9 months. His counsel were not deficient, if you look at the totality of their representation, but also this case is very easily decided on prejudice.
Let's talk about that. On the prejudice prong, the way I now understand the appellant's case is he says that if he had been correctly advised that he needed to get the RIFGOS before he pled guilty or before he got convicted for it to be effective, that his counsel would have taken rational and reasonable steps to push out the date of the trial as far as was reasonable, because he's got this Hail Mary pass hanging out there and he doesn't know yet whether or not it's going to be caught. And how, assuming that's an accurate description of appellant's argument, how do we evaluate the prejudice there? Because here we're not talking about, you know, you're right. I understand what you're saying about the how good the deal was and how might, if you had had to stand up and say, plead not guilty or guilty, there's a tremendous amount of evidence that it made a lot of sense to plead not guilty. But that's not really what he's arguing. He's arguing that he just wanted to try and delay making that decision until he found out whether or not his Hail Mary pass got caught. So how do we evaluate that argument for prejudice?
Well, pretrial would have been extremely speculative. As much as appellant relies on the fact that the RIFGOS was approved X number of days after his trial, there's no way of knowing how long that action would have taken. So this court would have to speculate greatly to say if he had done an Article 32, it would have delayed the process however many days, and his counsel would have believed that maybe that would get him to the finish line and wait to be able to see his Hail Mary pass, whether it was caught or not. All of that is extremely speculative, and there's nothing within the record to support that there would have been a different outcome. At arraignment, his trial date was set for 18 April. When he pled guilty, the government didn't ask for an earlier trial date. It stayed consistent. It was April 18th, and he deferred pleas at arraignment, and when the day of trial came, the train had left the station. He had two choices.
But isn't his whole argument that that's his prejudice, right? His counsel was operating under erroneous beliefs about the way this all worked, and therefore he made all these decisions that he would not have made if he knew how the regime works.
Well, it's effectively what appellant is arguing is that he wishes that his trial could have taken place later. And a continuance was not, there's no authority to support a continuance. The regulations themselves, 2710 and 600-8-24, say that a RIFGOS will not preclude or suspend court-martial procedures. Additionally, the military judge signaled at arraignment when he was informed about the convening authority's recommendation against approval, he said, we will continue on with the court-martial until we are told otherwise. There is no authority that would have told him otherwise. The regulations say to continue.
Right.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is there any evidence in the record about the percentage of these that are approved or how long on average they take to be approved? Is there anything in the record that tells us how reasonable, if he says, I just needed to push it out a month or 2 months or 3 months to find out what was going to happen with this process? Is there anything currently in the record that tells us how reasonable of an expectation that might have been?
There's nothing within the record, Your Honor. And actually, there is evidence within the JA which supports an alternate position. Neither regulation gives any timeline for a Secretary of the Army to act. So appellant would have had to come in when he requested his continuance. He would have had to ask for an indefinite delay. He would not have known how many days he was asking for because he wouldn't have been able to know when his RIFGOS would have been acted upon. So he would have had to ask for an indefinite delay on a completely separate and distinct administrative matter that had no approval from the chain of command, from company level all the way up to the convening authority. This is more than a Hail Mary pass. There was absolutely, based on the facts that were known to the counsel and the military judge, there was no reason for them to believe that it may have gotten approved. And appellant does look to De Los Santos, Vance, and Brown. However, those are three cases, and saying that in all of those, the chain of command had recommended against disapproval, yet it still got approved. Those three cases are three cases, but we don't know how many cases are out there, and there's nothing within the record to show in that instance how often it is disapproved by the Secretary of the Army, which is the far more likely outcome. So, appellant, when he came into court on April 18th, he had two choices, to plead guilty or not guilty. The only reasonable choice was for him to plead guilty. And the standard set forth in Bradley asked for both a subjective and an objective prong. Appellant doesn't satisfy the subjective within his affidavit, saying that he would have pled not guilty. And
On that point, I mean, he does say in his declaration that he would not have pled guilty, and he says that we just have to accept that that is true because it's uncontested. You don't have to have an evidentiary hearing on it or anything else like that. He said he would not have pled guilty, and we just have to accept that. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, and that's the reason that this court set forth two prongs in a guilty plea context. So there's the subjective prong where appellant has to say that he would have pled not guilty. And then the second prong is an objective prong because the court isn't just going to take appellant's word that he would have pled not guilty when he makes a post-trial affidavit. They need to assess objectively would it have made sense. And in Lee, so the distinction with Lee, he was trying to avoid deportation. He believed if he had pled guilty, he was going to avoid deportation. He was wrongly advised, and the only way he could have avoided deportation was to plead not guilty. In this case, appellant claims that he wished to avoid a conviction at all costs. However, if that were the case, even based on the advice that he received on the RIFCOS, the erroneous advice, he still would have pled not guilty when he walked into court on April 18th, if his sole goal was to avoid a conviction. So the evidence points against the fact that appellant wished to avoid a conviction at all costs. It's just not there. Otherwise, knowing that the entire chain of command recommended against his RIFCOS, he would have pled not guilty on April 18th.
Do we have to have an evidentiary hearing on that specific issue?
No, Your Honor. I think it is within this court's purview to be able to analyze those two prompts, whether subjectively and objectively, appellant would have pled guilty. The Army Court pulled some facts in order to help to try to establish those. If this court feels that those are insufficient in order to determine whether the subjective and objective prongs can be met, then an evidentiary hearing may be warranted. However, the government's position is that the evidence that is before the court here now can easily dispose of this case under the prejudice prong of Strickland. Pending any further questions, for these reasons, appellant has failed to show that if he had been advised differently, it would have resulted in a different outcome. Accordingly, the government asks that this court affirm the findings or affirm the judgment of the Army Court.
Judge Sparks, do you have any questions?
I have no questions.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government spoke to great lengths about speculation. I would just reiterate that, as we saw in United States versus Brown, counsel called there and they got a timeline from HRC. That could have happened here. The second part to this whole speculation, I see you look like you didn't understand that.
I didn't understand sure. that. Say yeah. that again.
So the government basically argued there's no way they could have known how long this was going to take. They would have needed an indefinite delay. But that's not true. In United States versus Brown, counsel called up HRC and they said, how long is the RIFCOS going to take? And HRC told them. And that could have happened here too had counsel not been deficient. The second point of speculation is that this court held in United States versus Lee in 1999 that when the court knows, when it's looking at prejudice, when it knows what in fact would have happened, it doesn't need to engage in guesswork and speculation. And here we know what happened. The RIFCOS was approved, and it was approved 34 days later. So we know it was approved. The only question then is, could we have gotten those extra 34 days? As I discussed earlier, had he been properly advised from the get-go, he would have told counsel, I'm not pleading guilty with this thing pending, and counsel would have been forced to prepare for trial, and that would have gotten us those 34 days.
What are you basing that on? As the government counsel noted, the military judge way back in arraignment specifically said, quote, that he was going to proceed with trial as scheduled unless or until told otherwise. There was nothing here, no one who was going to tell him otherwise. Furthermore, this was as simple a case to prosecute and to defend as you get walking through a courthouse door. So in terms of the military judge just saying, sure, I'll give you a continuance. Maybe things have changed since my days in courts-martial, but I'd be shocked to have a military judge just say, sure, I'm going to continue this, despite the fact that we've had this arraignment some time ago, and this is a clear-cut case.
Your Honor, I'm not just talking about the continuance. I'm talking about trial preparation. I'm talking about what happened before April of 2018. when counsel waived their preliminary hearing, when counsel did not submit a discovery request. Counsel did all those things and took all those steps because they didn't realize that there was any conflict and friction between the OTP and the RIF goss. If they had realized those things, they would have had to prepare for trial. They would have had to request a discovery.
Well, I don't know what counsel needs to prepare for. This is ye olde AWOL case where they put in the morning report and say, here you are.
Well, it's a paper case, Your Honor, and paper cases require...
And the 27K.
Authentication documents, a challenge for the defense to challenge those documents. And again, I think the real take-home message from Lee is that even if this were a long shot, Lieutenant Firth was entitled to go for it.
He went for it, and the ball nestled into the receiver's arm.
He didn't go for it, Your Honor, because his counsel had erroneously advised him. And had his counsel not erroneously advised him, we wouldn't be here today. Thank you.
Judge Sparks?
No, I don't have any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Chief Judge.
The court thanks counsel for both sides. And again, the court thanks counsel for their efforts in getting here today, which I'm sure weren't fun. Nonetheless, we've got our arguments done. And the court is now in recess pending further order of the court.